It is so important that all of us, and I think the legal community here has a big role to play, to be open towards supporting in word and deed what we are actually trying to achieve.
This will prove that this mechanism is for restoration of justice, not purely for Ukraine, but for justice.
What we're describing would be the largest European recovery program since the Marshall Plan. A program that would galvanize the whole future of Europe, anchored in the recovery of Ukraine.
The ongoing debate of how to compensate Ukrainians affected by the war reached a crucial juncture in April. The Council of Europe voted to use seized Russian assets to fund Ukraine's reconstruction. A week later, the US House of Representatives finally approved billions of dollars in new US military aid to help Ukraine combat Russia's invasion. The legislation also authorizes the US government to seize frozen Russian central bank assets held in US jurisdictions to help rebuild the country. As deliberations over the seizure of Russian sovereign assets continue to vex G7 leaders, Global Insight spoke to three experts about what legal steps are being taken globally to ensure Ukrainians get the compensation they deserve. First, Irina Mudra, Ukraine's Deputy Minister of Justice, speaks about the progress that has been made on establishing an international compensation mechanism for Ukraine.
Work on the compensation mechanism began in the early days of the war, at the beginning of 2022, when the concept of the international compensation mechanism was first presented to our partners. But by November 2022, we already had a United Nations General Assembly resolution supported by 94 countries, whereby it recognized that Russia must be held to account for its violations of international law in Ukraine, including by way of making reparation. The resolution recognized the need of an international mechanism for reparation and recommended the establishment of the International Register of Damage as a first step. The register will serve as a database or a catalog for all the information about the victims who suffered damage, loss, and injury, information provided by them, including the evidence proving the damages.
Robert Spano is chair of the board of the International Register of Damage for Ukraine. He talks about the evolution of the register, which opened submissions for its first category of claims in April.
The board was elected by the Conference of Participants, which are the participant states and associate member states, in November. So the first part of our work is to draft our rules and regulations, the rules and regulations about the procedure of the register, examination of claims categories, how those claims forms will look like, what will be the sequence of the claims submission process. Because all of these rules and regulations have to then be adopted by the board, which we did during our second meeting, which occurred now at the end of February. And these rules and regulations go then to the Conference of Participants, again, the member states, for adoption. We have been finalizing this first part of the rulemaking process.
And which legal issues still need to be ironed out?
There are a number of legal issues we have to consider. We are an international body, which is regulated by an international treaty, which is the statute of the Register of Damage. There are certain eligibility criteria, which the statute speaks of, some of which do not pose difficult interpretational questions. For example, that this is only related to damage, loss, or injury caused after 24 February 2022, when Russia invaded Ukraine. Secondly, it is clear who the claimants can be, and that is all individuals, legal persons, and the state of Ukraine that can demonstrate that they have a claim which results from an internationally wrongful act of the Russian Federation. And there are, I would say, a couple of issues we need to think about. The first is, what constitutes an internationally wrongful act within the meaning of the statute? Because that then opens up a claims process that takes account of those kinds of claims? And secondly, what kind of damage, loss, or injury is compensable? Because we have to think about that in terms of the current principles under international law.
Finalizing the categories of claims has been a key focus of the board members recently. Why do you think damage or destruction of residential immovable property is the best place to start?
We received a proposal from the government of Ukraine during our first meeting, which has formed the basis of our work. There are two main reasons why we've started with this pilot submission process, which you mentioned, damage to residential property. The first is that has impacted thousands, if not hundreds of thousands of lives. We estimate that this category will encompass about 300,000 to 600,000 claims. So first, it's the impact, the general impact. The second is more a question of efficiency. We have readily accessible data about this claims category. It's in local data banks, it's registered. So it will allow us to test our technology, because this, if you can imagine, this will be a process with us receiving from 8 to 10 million claims. So it's going to be automation, which is going to be key. I mean, no human being will be able to process all of this individually. We will have to have a very strong technological filter and an examination process. And so starting with this claims category allows us to do these two things: make meaningful impact on people's lives, but also test the technology.
Do you believe the register can deliver Ukrainians the compensation that they deserve?
I wouldn't be doing this if I didn't believe that. I'm a practicing international lawyer in a large American law firm. Taking time to do this alongside is not an easy decision. And that goes for other board members as well. Putting that aside, the register of damage is just the first stage. This is a precursor and a first step to the establishment of a compensation mechanism, which is the actual organization which will deliver justice, but subject to political stakeholders making two decisions which are fundamental. The first is to establish the compensation mechanism. That hasn't happened yet. And secondly, to secure Russian assets to be able to fulfill those claims. For us to be successful, it's not really us that count that much. It is what happens next. And that's why I have called upon all of the multinational stakeholders and political power holders, which are the ones that will ultimately decide whether this will bring justice to the Ukrainian people, to bear that responsibility. But it is so important that all of us, and I think the legal community here has a big role to play, to be open towards supporting in word and deed what we are actually trying to achieve.
Irina Mudra believes the process will provide the necessary legitimacy and speed to help Ukrainians as the war continues.
Let's just remember how many years court proceedings in investment arbitrations or European Court of Human Rights or ICJ can last. So years, from 5 years and more. To add to this, we have to be mindful who will be the respondent, Russian Federation. Many judgments issued by the courts against Russia, which have been executed, which have been enforced. We can just remember those investment arbitrations in Yukos case or in private and public investors with regards to assets lost in Crimea. So there are already existing enforceable judgments which are not executed, because Russia never respected rule of law and international law. That's why, but unfortunately, the mentioned courts, they are not able to ensure consideration of the reparation claims for damage caused by the war. And of course, even that is why there was a need to create a new administrative procedure from the scratch. But of course, even the adoption of a single resolution, especially when it comes to seeking justice from the aggressor state like Russia, it takes time. It takes a long time and requires the efforts of many actors. And if you look at the experience of in past of the previous compensation mechanism, like in Iraq-Kuwait Claims Commission, and we took this as a model for our compensation mechanism, the time frame is really quite long. But the war is still going on. The damage and number of victims are growing. Ukraine and Ukrainians cannot simply wait until the war ends. That's why the parties are forced to look for various means to provide compensation. But it is important to mention that this will be an international mechanism in order to have legitimacy, in order to have global support, and to be treated as a global legitimate mechanism. It should be an international, but not purely Ukrainian one. That's why we are talking with our partners, with G7 states, including European Union. But moreover, we aim to target also countries from South, global South, from the eastern part of the world, because this will prove that this mechanism is for restoration of justice, not purely for Ukraine, but for justice, right? For to make the international law be responsive to the act of aggression, despite who will be the aggressor. And it might serve as a deterrent in the future for future aggressors.
Global Insight also spoke to Philip Zelico, a senior fellow at Stanford University's Hoover Institution in the US. He has been one of the leading lawyers advocating for states to transfer frozen Russian assets to compensate Ukraine for the damage inflicted by the war.
The legal argument is straightforward. It's the use of state countermeasures in order to respond to an extremely serious violation of international law. This whole issue of Russian assets has, I think, perhaps been the greatest challenge to international law of this generation. It flummoxed international lawyers as to how to do this, as to how to handle this. Partly in order to counter this, I joined with other leading international lawyers, and we basically said, who are like the, you know, 9 or 10 best international law practitioners in the world? Can we get them to all join a memorandum explaining our position so that people can see that actually some of the people who are the most renowned practitioners of international law, not just academics, are actually on board with this theory and support it? So we did that. And there's still some concern among international lawyers about the precedent this would set. Do you set the precedent in which Russia is made to pay? Or do you set the precedent in which Russia does not have to pay? Either of these precedents are consequential. So our generation has to, of international lawyers, has to decide which precedent we wish to be set. I think it's more important to set the precedent that the aggressor should pay, rather than set the precedent that in the largest case of international aggression since the founding of the United Nations, the international community decided that the aggressor did not have to pay. That would be a devastating precedent. The leading governments have now worked through the fact that they do have standing to take the countermeasures. They also have realized that they have jurisdiction over quite a lot of money. The money is deposited in European depositories. But the money in the European depositories is, a lot of that money is not European. They're in British pound sterling, US dollars, Canadian dollars, and even Australian dollars. That's nearly 40% of the funds deposited at Euroclear. So there is obviously a basis for jurisdiction over this money, even though people think it's being held, quote, in Europe. The Russian assets would be should be confiscated and transferred and held in escrow to compensate the victims damaged by Russia's aggression. It's true that the overwhelming majority of that money will go to Ukraine and Ukrainians. But there are other victims damaged by Russia's aggression including companies that are confiscated as a result of Russia's aggression, that will have valid claims. And we need to set up a claims process in which those companies can get at least some compensation for being victimized in this way, because, of course, these Russian confiscations are unlawful. I mean, the companies themselves have not done anything wrong.
And you reference the international compensation mechanism itself. Can you give a little bit more detail on what, how do you think it should look like, or what should it look like?
The national governments transfer the frozen assets into their own escrow accounts. Then you transfer the money into international escrow accounts that are dedicated to the purpose of compensating the victims of Russia's aggression. You then have to create a set of trustees for those escrowed accounts, the management and disbursement of the funds, for two purposes, two buckets. Bucket number one, a programs bucket. Bucket number two, a claims bucket. So in both cases, you would need some institutional innovation to manage the disbursement of funds. What we're describing would be the largest European recovery program since the Marshall Plan, a program that would galvanize the whole future of Europe anchored in the recovery of Ukraine and radiating outward from that with expenditures of these enormous sums, which themselves, by the way, could anchor and be the basis for private investments using risk insurance and partnerships that they then create multipliers of private investment that even if you conservatively estimated those multipliers at a one-to-one level, you begin to see the scale of money movement that could be unlocked by the shrewd use of the Russian funds, and actually offers exceptionally bright prospects for Europe's future, which in a way, that is the ultimate defeat of Putin's ambitions. If Ukraine can survive and thrive, and both Ukraine and Europe prosper together, in a way, it almost then doesn't matter so much exactly where the final battle lines end up.